Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, seeking to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics scholarship. And today is definitely going to be no exception. We are talking about the topic of ancient historiography today. How do we study ancient history? What's the proper methodology to use? And we have a very well-informed guest on the line to help with that. My guest today is Dr. Paul Meyer. Dr. Meyer, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, my audience might not know who you are, some of them. I hope a lot of them do already, but if they don't, why should they be paying attention to what you have to say today?
Okay, well, I've taught ancient history for almost half a century now at Western Michigan University, and the reason I started, Nick, was simply because I was fascinated by the idea that if these spectacular events really took place as reported in the Old and New Testament, we ought to be able to find some fallout in non-biblical secular material. And so I've been chasing down these points of tangency between the secular evidence and the sacred evidence, and we find that there are many such points of tangency. We find the one correlating with the other. And so I've written generally in the apologetics area, sometimes in the form first of bringing new evidence to bear, for example, in Pontius Pilate or the Great Fire of Rome, and why did Tacitus say that Nero blamed the Christians, and this kind of thing. In addition, of course, to books that talk about the correlation. My favorite book in that respect would be In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, in which, again, we bring out fresh information on Jesus and his greatest disciple, Paul of Tarsus. And therefore, it's been fun. I've been on, again, some national television shows and radio interviews, of course, and it's just been fun to try to bring to the public the idea that the sacred evidence is not out there alone, but that it's beautifully corroborated by secular evidence.
Well, you did mention Jesus, and I'd like my audience to know here that the plan that I've got in mind here is we're going to talk just ancient historiography at the start in general, and we're going to apply this to Jesus in the end. Dr. Meyer is only going to be here for an hour and a half today, so the last half hour you have to put up with me being real boring and such. But until we get to that last half hour, I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that we can really know a lot about ancient history, because if we want to know what's going on in recent history, like what happened last week or so, we just pull up the internet, go look at an old newspaper, talk to some people we know on the street and such, and we can find that information. But how do we find out about things that happened thousands of years ago?
Well, in a sense, it was the Greeks who invented history, per se, because Herodotus is the great father of history, as you well know. He wrote around 400 B.C. And generally, stories are stories. The ancients wrote history very much as moderns write history. What really happened? What were the circumstances? What was the location? Why did they happen? Who's involved? What was the result of this character's life and subsequent history and so on? So what you want to do is tell the big story, the most important story, truthfully, if you possibly can. They all claim to write without bias of any kind. Of course, they rarely do. But so ancient historiography is not that different, really, from modern historiography.
Well, you talked about bias, and I know for a lot of atheists out there who listen, they say as soon as you have any bias in a source, it's discounted. whatsoever. I mean, that's why you can't trust some sacred sources, because they have bias. But it sounds like you're telling me it's impossible to avoid bias.
Everybody writes with some inclination. You can kind of detect it depending on the sources they use, depending on how they handle those sources. And so it's noble to try to write without any bias of any kind, as Cornelius Tacitus, one of the great Roman historians, claims to do. Nevertheless, we can tell he's a Republican. He hates the emperors, and shines right through in his whole prose. And so also, people have tried to attack the Bible, for example. The Gospel of John says, "These things are written that you may believe." Well, how big a bias is that? Obviously, it's a pro-Christian bias. But we got to be, one thing's very clear. Bias does not necessarily connote untruth. Not at all. It doesn't connote even exaggeration. The way I usually answer it is this. If these things really happened, as the Bible claimed they did, well, then, wouldn't you expect the record to come out exactly as it did? I think it would be exactly written the same way.
But there are still some differences in ancient history. Today, for instance, if a major event happens, before too long, you'll have thousands of people all over the world writing about it. In the blogosphere, you can go out and you can find numerous comments everywhere. But in the ancient world, we don't have nearly as many records, because not as many people were writing about matters. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh, absolutely. When we're talking about the readership, it's vastly different in terms of the ancient documents compared to history as it transpires today. Well, you know, today, we're all major eyewitnesses of what's taking place. That'd be impossible in the ancient world, of course. And therefore, in a sense, the obligation for the ancient historian was even harder. He has to do as accurate a job as he can, because people were not eyewitnesses. Today, so many of them are.
And furthermore, back then, much of the information was spread through oral communication, and fewer people could read or write well. So not as many people would read things in books. So when we read a historical account, we're not getting the only account that would have been around back then, and we have to be on the lookout to see if there were oral traditions going around. Is that right?
Oh, you bet. You bet. Probably the majority came by oral tradition. And this is why the written word was so very important to nail down and guarantee what actually happened. That's why it's really amazing to me that the four gospel writers wrote when they did, because at the time, everyone was expecting the second coming of Christ by the year 100, for example, and therefore it's amazing they ever took pen in hand to write in the first place. I'm glad they did. Glad they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, because we're told that the events are so close to the time, and that is important. How important is it when you're doing ancient historiography, which is, say, to have records that are close to the time of the event?
Well, no question that in any age, ancient, medieval, or modern, the closer you are to reporting the actual events, the better it is, because then memory has not had a chance to fiddle with the facts. You have a clearer recollection. People tend to lose details in time. That's the way we're put together, unfortunately. And this is why the written word is so very important, because from that point on, it's frozen. It's absolute from the time you write it down. And for that reason, the earliest writing in the New Testament, for example, Paul, writing 1 Corinthians, is doing this 19 and a half years after the event. Now, this is very, very close to the event compared to so many other spiritual biographies, for example, the first documented written story about Siddhartha Gautama Buddha was 200 years after his death, and Muhammad also. But in our case, we have within a score of years the same things that the Gospel will report a little bit later on, the Gospels will.
And when we're talking about that epistle, we've even got in there in 1 Corinthians 15 that creed that dates to, I think, within the latest 5 years of the event.
You got it. Absolutely. Yeah, you have that earliest confession for sure.
Now, we're often
form of God. Yeah, go on.
Now, we're often told that when we engage with atheists on the internet and such, that the only historical sources that are valid are contemporary eyewitness accounts. Now, if we went through ancient history and said, we're only going to accept sources that are contemporary and eyewitness, how much ancient history would we have?
Well, we'd lose quite a bit, wouldn't we? But mm-hmm. I think the premise is wrong. I wouldn't let an atheist get away with that claim that mm-hmm. there were no eyewitness accounts. There certainly were. For example, take the second half of the book of Acts. Luke is writing, and he is on board all these events. He's there as an eyewitness and an ear witness. He was there from the second mission journey of Paul on through the shipwreck voyage to Rome on to Paul in prison in Rome. I mean, this is eyewitness reporting. And of course, he learned the other details of Jesus' life, learned the nativity details from Mary. Luke virtually tells us that in a couple of footnotes that he has to his gospel. Namely, but Mary kept all these things, pondering them in her heart, showing where Luke got that information. So he gets from an eyewitness. And then also the apostles were eyewitnesses, and they told Luke the rest of the story of Jesus while Paul was in prison after the third mission journey. So Luke's running kind of the postal service between Caesarea, where Paul was in prison, and pillars of the church in Jerusalem.
Well, something that I hear often used, and I know Gary Habermas used it in his debate with Victor Stinger, and he's used it in debates with others, is when we talk about the Gospels, which is being written decades later. Here asks the question, how much later are the first biographies of Alexander the Great? Now, could you expand on why he asked such a question?
Well, yes, he would be... He was trying to show the atheists that reliable history can be written by those even a generation or two later. For instance, I'm just reviewing a book by Candida Moss. It's a bad book, claiming the myth of persecution, in which she claims that the martyr stories of the early church were largely way exaggerated. And she uses as an example, this is just incredible, that Tacitus was writing 50 years after the event. Now, on paper, this looks like quite a distance. But look, that would be like saying today you cannot write accurately about the Kennedy administration. That happened 50 years ago. Give me a break. See, and so this argument falls on its face. They always try to use time. They're always saying these things were written later and therefore not reliable. Well, come on. We know that accurate information can be written about Kennedy's assassination. We just celebrated the anniversary here a couple weeks ago.
Okay, but so if we were to talk with not just you but several other ancient scholars, how many of them would accept this claim that only contemporary eyewitness accounts can be used in ancient history?
None of them. Not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not one.
Now, and there are a lot of figures in ancient history that we know of that we don't really even have any eyewitness accounts of. Alexander the Great is one of them. I've also been told the same applies to Hannibal.
Oh, yeah, we have very few sources on Hannibal other than Roman sources. Mm-hmm. And even those came later on, sure, after the Third Punic War. No, mm-hmm. there's no question that that's an exaggeration or wrong statement.
Now, when we're talking about how to do this kind of history, we do want our sources to be as close as possible. We do want them to be eyewitnesses, preferably. I mean, we can't always get what we want, of course, but what are some other aspects we're looking for in an ancient account to test its reliability?
Well, the context is very, very important. If you have an ancient source that's known to go off the deep end and exaggerating numbers and exaggerating this or that or the next thing, we use his record with a lot of care and concern because he could be beefing up his numbers or his opinion or whatever else. And so this is one sign, kind of a yellow light. Be careful of this person. But if he's known to be very, very clear with the facts and very honest and even somewhat unbiased, then the stuff is quite reliable. For example, one of the great modern historians that wrote about 400 B.C. was Thucydides, who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. and Thucydides beautifully actually claims that the Athenians and their attitude started it, and he himself was on the Athenian side. Now, this is the kind of thing which is very, very commendable, very accurate indeed. And so Thucydides is very generally regarded as a very, very fair historian of causation, and also with a minimal bias. This kind of thing is very attractive when you're looking. Therefore, the context is important. How does this person handle known facts as reported by other historians? And then, of course, we have other rules that apply also. If we're trying to figure out in ancient history whether somebody's claim that something happened is true, if he's the only one making that claim, and it's a really a spectacular event, and nobody else reports it, then it's kind of suspect, isn't it? But we use the criterion of what's called multiple attestation, meaning that if a lot of other ancient historians that aren't copying from one another are saying the same thing, well then, hey, it's almost a lead pipe cinch. These things really happened. Another rule of evaluating ancient evidence. You know, once again, if you find an ancient historian saying something, you've got to ask yourself, well, is he telling the truth? Or is he padding his numbers? Or is he exaggerating? Well, the context will tell you that, or multiple attestation will tell you that, an answer. Or another one that I love, this one I love. It's called the criterion of embarrassment.
Yep.
What does that mean? Well, okay, you have an ancient source running from A to Z, and en route to his goal, he has to tell you some evidence that doesn't help his thesis at all. It hurts it, as a matter of fact. But he's got to concede that evidence simply because everybody knows it's true at the time. Therefore, 2,000 years plus later, you know that's true. Whatever this guy has to concede that embarrasses him is true. And, of course, he'll try to wrap a cocoon around it. He'll try to explain it away. But then, 20 centuries later, you know, hey, that's true. And what's fascinating is a source in the Jewish rabbinical traditions on Jesus, which is a hostile source, obviously, okay?
Yeah.
Well, the arrest notice of Jesus is given in the Mishnah section of the Talmud, the great collection of Jewish writings. And it's nothing less than the arrest notice of Jesus. It goes something like this. Wanted, Yeshua HaNotzri, that's Jesus of Nazareth, he shall be stoned because he's practiced sorcery and lured Israel to apostasy. If anyone can say anything in his favor, let him declare it to the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Well, this is what's so terrific about that passage. It's a hostile source. And yet it concedes that Jesus is doing something extraordinary or supernatural. Give it a negative spin, it's sorcery. Give it a positive spin, it's called a miracle. So here you have, again, in a hostile source, the admission that Jesus is doing something supernatural. So I love hostile sources as an ancient historian. I can sometimes squeeze more truth out of hostile sources by using that criterion of embarrassment than friendly sources.
Another source I've used along those lines is Origen replied to Celsus around the 3rd century or so, and Celsus had said that Jesus learned sorcery in Egypt. And as we know, Celsus was no friend of Christianity, but
that's
he had
great,
to explain
great, that's
something.
That's a great parallel, Nick, yes.
Yeah.
You know, Celsus, of course, was one of the first great critics against the faith, and Origen, again, in writing Contra Celsum, against Celsus, I love that statement, and it's a beautiful, another example of the criterion of embarrassment. Practice sorcery, learn sorcery in Egypt, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break, our first break for a moment. I'm here with Dr. Parmal, and I'll be giving you all the number to call in after this break. I'm Nick Peters. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. At www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back with Dr. Paul Meyer. Call-in number, if you want to call in and ask a question here, is 714-242-5180. And Dr. Meyer, listening to the joy in your voice and all this, I'm reminded that, as some listeners know, I'm getting ready to work on my own master's in New Testament here. And Mike, my father-in-law, Mike Lacona, had said to me one time, said, Nick, I want you to be very careful, though, when you start reading works on how ancient historiography and such are done. And I said, why? He said, because it's extremely addictive. You'll find it's so much fun to read about how ancient history is done. I'm guessing you'd agree about 100%.
I certainly would. Yeah, Nick Lacona is a great defender of the faith. We've been in touch quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about this criterion of embarrassment. What someone could say, though, and has been sending responses, that, well, some things we find embarrassing today, they might not have found as embarrassing back then. So maybe this whole criterion is just wrong.
Well, clearly, they're using the basic rules of logic we do today. And again, for a hostile source to claim that Jesus was doing something miraculous was not in their favor. They might have shut up about it, but in admitting it, they demonstrate the truth of that claim. This is what's so interesting. Another example would be Cornelius Tacitus of Rome. Now, he, of course, mentions Jesus and Pontius Pilate and the crucifixion and so forth. And he's a pagan who doesn't like the Christians at all, but nevertheless... Mm-hmm. His famous passage in Annals, Book 15, Section 44, is one of the most important outside references we have to Jesus. This is the bone in the throat of all those poor, benighted people nowadays who claim that Jesus never lived. You know, I'm surprised this thing gets off of first base. I thought that went out with high-button shoes years ago, but they're still resurrecting that idea. There's even a blog today, JesusNeverExisted.com. And these people pathetically try to claim that there wasn't even a historical Jesus, not to say certainly not the Son of God. It makes me think I come from another planet. These people are absolutely denying all logic in the process. Here we have, in a pagan Roman historian, the reference to the Great Fire of Rome in the year 64. And that because it happened on Nero's watch, and because the public was so poorly informed, no TV in those days with a minicam telling you on the spot what happened, you're witnessing it, that Nero got blamed for it. It happened on his watch. And so to save himself, Tacitus carefully tells us he blamed the Christians. And then, careful scholar that he was, he explains who the Christians were, their name for a Christ, who was crucified by one of our governors, Pontius Pilate. And the pernicious superstition was almost eradicated until suddenly it gained new vigor. You went outside reference to Eastern Pentecost, there it is. Suddenly gained new vigor and even flowed as far away as Rome, that common cesspool into which things hateful come from all over the Mediterranean. You can tell he regards the Christians as so much sewage, so this is not some early Christian apologist or defender that trying to defend the faith. No, here's a hostile witness. But he's honest enough to say, yeah, there was a Christ. Yeah, there was a Pontius Pilate. And indeed, it's a beautiful outside testimony, a criterion of embarrassment, except Tacitus never thought they would amount to anything and therefore didn't feel it necessary not to include that information. He does. He's honest. And he simply really goes on to say exactly what the great church historian Eusebius will say later on, that there were a great multitude of Christians that were persecuted. So I love hostile sources. Watch what they concede.
You know, you've got, Mike Lacona does quote you in his book on the resurrection of Jesus, where he talks about the Christmas position and says, first off, no widely respected scholar holds this position. So before I even tell you what his quote is, what would you say that no widely respected scholar holds the Christmas position?
The Christ what position?
The Christmas position.
Oh, Christmas position. No, I would agree. And, you know, here's an interesting thing, Nick. I find that my colleagues in secular ancient history have a far greater appreciation of the historical reliability of the Old and New Testament than do Christian historians, than do theological historians. They're the ones who are the extreme ultra-higher critics who hold these things up for scorn in terms of their reliability, not the ancient historians. Generally, the secular ancient historical world is far more congenial to the biblical documents than the so-called Christians who, you know, love to saw off the very limbs in which they're sitting.
Could you give us some names of people we could check into for that, the secular historians who do take these claims very seriously?
Oh, sure. Adrian Sherwin White, hyphenated English scholar of ancient history, who likes to do the same thing I do, and that is to compare the secular events with the sacred. And he comes out saying, well, look, we're acquainted with how shoddy sometimes ancient history is being written in the secular world, and so the biblical documents that may occasionally exaggerate a little bit something or other, they read soberly compared to some of the results of the other ancient historians. And so they're very critical also of their predecessors in ancient history when they go off the deep end. So these are very reliable people.
Well, this is the quote that Mike gives of you concerning the idea that Jesus never existed, and it looks like you're not holding anything back. He says, "The total evidence is so overpowering, so absolute, that only the shallowest of intellects would dare to deny Jesus' existence."
Absolutely right.
And unfortunately, for those of us who do a lot of debating on the internet, this is one of the most common positions held out there, especially with someone like Richard Carrier being seen as practically the apostle of the new atheism, who does hold that Jesus never existed.
Well, you know, anybody, and I don't care what his name is or in what repute he is, anybody who claims that Jesus never lived is simply flaunting, absolutely flaunting his ignorance or a horrendous bias for which we look for nothing more truth from out of his mouth. This is a ridiculous. You know, even Bart Ehrman, the loudmouth whom you see all the time on radio and television, even Bart Ehrman, critical as he is, admits, yes, Jesus did exist. Isn't that nice of him?
Yeah, I've got his book, Did Jesus Exist? I've read it. I've written a review of it. And in fact, one reason I read it, I'd had it on my shelf. It's one of those books I've been meaning to read for a while, but I hadn't until Gary Habermas kept telling me over and over, you gotta read this book. And he lost a lot of followers, I think, in the atheist community when he came out and said,
oh, yeah, regarded as a pain of the turncoat, yeah.
And in fact,
basically honest in that respect, my goodness. I mean, I don't even know why the debate goes on. I mean, we have more evidence of Jesus as a historical personality than many figures in the ancient world.
Could you name some of those figures in the ancient world you think we have more evidence of Jesus for than those figures, but those figures aren't questioned?
Well, I would say in terms of the primary sources, almost anyone in the ancient world. I'll make an exception with Herod the Great, because Josephus gives us a whole two books of a court history on Herod the Great. But nearly everybody else rests on much shallower evidence than Jesus does. It's just such a ridiculous double standard. You see, the critics think this is kind of a cutesy shortcut to demolishing the figure of Jesus. He never even existed. Where are we talking? You know, and it's such a stupid shortcut. Stupid.
And the sad reality is that the reason this goes on is because many atheists just don't know how to do history. And in fact, sadly, I'd say most Christians don't know how to do history. I think one of the mistakes we make.
Well, that's true, and I'm sure the great public doesn't know how to do history either. And I think the what worries me is not that intelligent Christians are going to be derailed by the claim that Jesus never lived. Of course they won't. But I'm worried about the marginal people. I'm worried about those who are religion shopping. I'm worried about those who are looking for an excuse to give up the faith. And these are the people who are impacted by these marginal minds that come out and make these impossible claims. This is the damage done even by novels. You know, Brown's the crazy book on Leonardo
da Vinci. Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code, yeah. These are the people who Well, here at Western Michigan University, we had a very bright German student who got a German national scholarship to come over here, and also was aided financially also by our university. They were having a dorm discussion one evening, and they were discussing religion, and somebody mentioned Christianity, and she said, well, that's been disproven by the Da Vinci Code. Give me a break. Now, a very shabbily written novel is now a reason for undermining the faith. Give me a break. But this is what the marginal mind thinks and says.
I can tell you, as soon as I heard that, I just did a double face palm over here. It's beyond ridiculous, as far as I'm concerned. And so many people take it seriously, just like how you see these Bible programs on the History Channel, for instance, where you would hope to expect by the name you'd find good history. And usually what I find there is, let's go out and get the most radical proponents we can of an idea and use them and treat them as if they're mainstream.
Exactly. They always have the radicals on. They never have those who want to tell the other side. Some years ago, a U.S. News and World Report was fairer in that respect. They heard both sides. ABC television did a special on Jesus and Paul some years ago in which they were also fair. They would show the extreme radically left position and then the conservative position. They were more honest in terms of the balance of the evidence. But lately, sensation sells. Whatever is off the wall, whatever is over the top, whatever is going to cause a big ripple, that attracts the crowds, and therefore sensationalism sells.
I think one of the reasons we have such a hard time with history today is our culture has been overrun by a kind of scientism mindset that we can't test these things scientifically, and history is not science, therefore we can't trust history the way we trust science. What do you think about that kind of comparison?
Well, I think it's making a false dichotomy between history as a discipline and science as a discipline. Science also doesn't always follow objective rules. For example, to claim a priori that the supernatural is impossible, right there is a mistake. That's one of the scientific, you know, postulates. It's simply a mistake. And so to claim that history cannot be a science is also wrong. Historia, the Greek word, means inquiry. And indeed, you try to be as honest as you possibly can. It has its own rules. They shouldn't be violated. And so to call history sub-science is wrong.
Now, would you say there's also such a thing as a historical method, just as there is a scientific method?
Exactly, sure.
Now, if you were going to do a historical method and describe it to someone, how would you describe the historical method?
Well, the historical methodology basically is to try to clear away any accretions to the original evidence, test out the original evidence in terms of any known biases of the source, see if that historical evidence is borne out by other testimonies, see if there's a way of affirming or denying the historical evidence against the background, test it again by all those means, criteria of credibility, and then you come with your result.
No,
and there are many other tests you can put on it besides the ones I've just mentioned.
Now, let's suppose that we've pretty much got bits and pieces in many cases of ancient history. Let's suppose there's a non-miraculous occurrence of sorts, but only one historian mentions it. Do we generally give that historian the benefit of a doubt?
Yes, we would say if what is claimed is reasonable and logical in terms of the flow of the story, if only one historian mentions that it didn't happen, no, that would be a wrong conclusion. And so we'd evaluate what is claimed. We'll see if it fits that time and space frame. And if it does, well, then certainly in the absent any contrary evidence, we'd probably say that did happen, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting about how we talk about multiple attestations, because for some events that are just would be seen as major, we have very little attestation. I think one such example usually given is the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD that destroyed two cities, killing 250,000 people.
And well, that's, of course, reported by Pliny the Younger. Go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
but,
also cast, yeah.
In fact, I think when Pliny writes about it, it's more an offhand comment saying, yeah, my uncle died this way. He proved you shouldn't get too close to a volcano when you're studying
exactly.
It.
And stick to the books. He was too busy to go across the bay with his uncle to see, to rescue people. Yeah, he was, we're kind of glad he was, because later on his letter to Trajan regarding the Christians is so very important.
Yeah, and this also can get us into the oral tradition, why it was so important, but people today will often say, well, your memory wouldn't be as good 50 years after the Kennedy assassination, and when we have accounts that show up 50 years later where you know how bad memory is, we just can't trust it.
Well, clearly, the Kennedy assassination was tremendously assisted by visual and audio recording devices, which made it a universal phenomenon that everybody knew about. Everybody knows where they were at the time Kennedy was assassinated. Now, to be sure, the ancient world didn't have this kind of a widespread memory or recall devices. But nevertheless, you can report accurate history centuries later, yes.
We had Brent Sandy come on here earlier, and he was talking about the book that he wrote with John Walton recently, The Lost World of Scripture. And one of the main emphases I noticed in that book over and over is that despite what people think, oral tradition can be extremely reliable in the ancient world.
Oh, yeah. There's no question, especially before the invention of writing or the invention of textual transmission and so on, the oral traditions are all that they had. And so, indeed, the information comes down to Moses through centuries in which we don't have writing, and also the story of the Trojan War, for example. We don't have any writing the same way at the time before Homer, but yet we have an accurate, pretty accurate vision of what took place from the Iliad. Again, the Schliemann proved that. He was a Homer buff, and everybody was regarding the whole concept of the Mycenaean invasion of the Trojans as some kind of early Greek myth, you know, until he dug at Troy and found Troy, you know, and Mycenae, the place that got it started. And all this came to Homer by tradition. He's not even writing history, he's writing an epic. But the fundamentals of that epic turned out to be true.
Yeah. And what we can also get with a lot of times with oral tradition is, and Bart Ehrman argues this, which I find to be extremely dishonest, in all honesty, is that it was more like a game of telephone back then, to which no one could go and check on the claims, where you just believed second-hand or third-hand testimony, and the whole thing could get out of hand.
Yeah, well, for instance, the game of telephone is a kind of a ridiculous example of bad oral tradition, no question about that. But I don't know of no one in the modern era who has made such a towering snow-capped mountain out of the flattest little molehill that you can find as Bart Ehrman. I mean, his whole argument is specious. We have 5,700 fragments of the New Testament, for example, in whole or in part, and therefore, sure, you're going to have tiny little errors, or I should say variations in terms of spelling or word order or punctuation. That's to be expected. But not one of these in any way impacts any major doctrine of the faith. And so I just, and with all those numbers, there's no other text of the ancient world that has 5,700 manuscripts in whole or in part, and naturally you're going to find permutations and combinations of these that are going to amount to, yeah, more variations in words in the New Testament. Sounds like a horrendous statement, but it's true. So what? None of these are significant. And so I just don't understand this tremendous fascination by his supposed research. It's really a sad example of where too fundamentalistic a Christian education drove somebody, you know, overboard into the opposite extreme.
Well, we're going to take a quick break right now. We're here with Dr. Paul Meyer, and we're talking about ancient historiography, how it's done, and we're getting more and more closer to how this applies to Jesus more. But I'll be back after this break with Dr. Paul Meyer. You're listening to the Deeper Waters Podcast.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
I'm here with Dr. Paul Meyer. We're talking about ancient historiography. The call-in number is 714-242-5180. If you want to ask a question, I think it's really interesting, Dr. Meyer, to hear what you said about Bart Ehrman being brought up too much in a fundamentalist background. In Fabricating Jesus, Craig Evans says the exact same thing, pretty much, that he just gets stunned when he reads about Ehrman's deconversion story with him receiving that paperback he wrote on Mark 2 and being told maybe Mark just made a mistake, and how this simple statement pretty much opens the floodgates, as it were. And you can tell it made a major impact on him, because in nearly every book that you read of his, that story shows up in there. And it does show us, I think, that in the Christian church, we're harping too much on secondary points and not teaching our Christians how to do real objective thinking, how to do real history, how to study the Gospels for themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. There really is a warning there in terms of worshiping the inerrant word too much and making it a shibboleth for true Christianity at a time when the message is being lost.
Yeah. I have a friend who I used to work with, and he attended the Crown College here in Tennessee, and it's extremely, extremely fundamentalist, KJV only. And he knew that I was big into apologetics, so a few years ago he has a kind of crisis of faith. And it starts by finding out the Johannine comma, that great passage for those who might know in 1 John 5, that supposedly talks about the Trinity, but really isn't authentic to what John wrote, that wasn't a real passage. So he came to me, and I was working with him, helping with some issues, and one morning, I remember I woke up and I had an email from him, and it had the subject line, Jesus of Nazareth. And I was thinking, okay, I wonder what this is going to be about. And I opened it up, and to this day, it's one of the best emails I've ever got, because all he said was, he really did walk out of that grave, didn't he?
Interesting. So he wasn't offended by the comma.
No, but we did have to respond to things like Bart Ehrman, and one thing that really helped him was when he read Gary Habermas's dissertation online, which I guess shows that, yes, sometimes your dissertation does get read. But these are the kinds of things that people will walk away from, unfortunately. And I was there to help him out, but a lot of people in the church might not know someone who knows these kinds of questions, these kinds of areas, to go to them, and they'll just throw the baby out with the bathwater entirely.
Yeah, well, that's a kind of a domino, faith or non-faith, and this is not the way to think properly.
Well, when we're also talking about how to do ancient history, we've been talking about manuscripts and things of that sort, but one area that we should include in this as well, and I'm hoping to get guests on like Craig Evans and Greg Manette to discuss this more, is that archaeology has really helped us out a lot, hasn't it?
Oh, you bet. You don't find this in the popular media. All you hear is the maunderings of the extreme ultra-liberal archaeologists, the biblical minimalists who are trying to cut down all connections between the hard evidence from the ancient world and the present evidence. But I would make a clear statement saying that 90% of archaeological evidence almost immediately supports anything in the Old or New Testament. Absolutely. And you don't hear that. And this is what's so pathetic. This is why people are led astray. Stupendous archaeological discoveries are being made that they don't even know about. And again, 9 out of 10 of these almost immediately support the biblical record. That's why I love archaeology. I call it the smoking gun from the ancient world, the DNA conclusive evidence one way or the other, which is does an end run around all the maunderings of the critics.
Could you give us some examples of what you think are some of the best archaeological findings that have helped to corroborate Scripture?
Sure. One example would be a German higher critic in the last century, his name Bruno Bauer. He at one time was a Christian, but he made shipwreck of his faith. He claimed that Jesus of Nazareth was not only not Son of God, that's a laugh, he couldn't have been a human being either. So he's a Jesus denier. And even his colleagues, he was pointing out that even those who intersected with Jesus were mythical. It's like somebody talking to Zeus. Well, obviously that never happened, and therefore the people who were talking to Zeus also must not be historical. And his colleagues were saying, well, wait a minute, Pontius Pilate is historical. He interviewed Jesus on Good Friday, obviously, but Bauer answered, no, Pilate's name was an interpolation that Christians put that into the records of Tacitus. Well, you know, too bad old Bruno wasn't around in 1962 when an archaeological team was excavating at Caesarea on the Mediterranean, and they came across a 2-by-3-foot cornerstone of Pontius Pilate. Yeah, his name's on it. To the people of Caesarea, Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, has presented the Tiberium. That's a building in honor of the Emperor Tiberius. So right there, we have hard evidence that Bruno was wrong, and I just wish that Bruno had survived into the 20th century so we could have gotten his head in an arm lock and carefully rubbed his nose in that inscription. He could have learned by the Braille method alone that there was a Pontius Pilate. So it's one example there. Another one would be the very prison area in which Paul was incarcerated in the 2-year imprisonment at Caesarea. That floor has been discovered at Herod's palace at Caesarea. Another one would be, well, how about this one? The bones of the first biblical personality ever to come to life were discovered in November of 1990. And Nick, what's incredible to me is I can be talking to a pastoral conference of 200 or 300 pastors, and I'll ask the question first, does anybody know about these biblical bones? Or who owned them at one time? And only about 2 or 3% of the audience knows. And this is not widely known, and I don't know why. It's an exciting find. I consider it as important as the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that is the bones of Joseph Caiaphas, for gosh sakes. The high priest of the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem who indicted Jesus in his hearings before Pontius Pilate on Thursday night before Good Friday. A very important person. Yes, his bones have been discovered. How come the world doesn't know about this? I don't know. BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review, had two big articles on it in 92 when the bones were first made public. And I don't know, maybe it didn't have that many readers. Nobody knows about these. And it's a wonderful story how it happened. They were discovered by accident. That's the best way, by the way, to have something discovered archaeologically. Don't be like the Chinese Noah's Ark Society that ta-dam, discovers Noah's Ark. You know, kind of indicating what you want to get. They were building a water park south of the temple area in the old city of Jerusalem. And the bulldozer starts sinking into the ground, backed it off, found they had punctured the roof of a burial cavern, called in the archaeologists. They shined their flashlight down to the hole, and there they found 10 ossuaries, stone chests for burying bones, and right away, therefore, they could date it to first century. The only time the Jews used that space-saving shortcut. See, they would put bodies of the dead into sepulchers, let them decay for a year or two, and then gather the bones that remain and put it in one of these bone boxes. Jesus himself was in what's called the second burial system. If it hadn't been for the resurrection, they'd have gathered his bones a year or two later. And so this was, of course, very, very important that in dating who the personality might be. And they pulled one of these bone boxes, these ossuaries, out of its niche. And on one side, they found beautiful carving, two giant rosettes with subhorals inside, implying that there's a VIP inside there. And then on the other side, inscribed in two-inch Latin lettering, were the Aramaic words, Yosef Bar Caiapha, Yosef Bar Caiapha, Joseph Caiaphas. And so they did carbon-14 dating on the bones. They found it was that of a 70-year-old man who indeed died about the year 70, and everything else works perfectly for Joseph Caiaphas. The Israel Museum in West Jerusalem used to have a question mark as to whether or not this was the Caiaphas of the New Testament, but now they've taken the question mark away. There are many other tests they used, and it's authentic. So I think here we have the judge on Good Friday. His name shows up in all four Gospels, shows up in Flavius Josephus, my favorite source, shows up again in some of the Roman records, and we also have the name of Joseph Caiaphas now, the high priest, showing up in all four Gospels in the Jewish rabbinic traditions and counterpart, the Roman version of Pontius Pilate, all over the place as well. You know, why do critics now superimpose a question mark over the Good Friday trial? This is ridiculous. This is incredibly documented by the fact itself. These things really happened.
And, you know, I'm just sitting here amazed to hear all this, because I read up on New Testament history as much as I can. I knew about this finding, and it saddens me that pastors don't, who should be leading and defending the flock.
Yeah.
But if there was, you know.
I'm not saying they're trying to bury the truth. They just didn't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why they
yeah.
didn't.
Yeah. Well, if there's one source that's usually considered to be especially helped by archaeology, it would be the work of Luke Acts, wouldn't it?
Isn't that true? He's my mm-hmm. favorite author in the Bible, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's the one who liked my particular method, or vice versa. I'm using Luke's method, and that is, Luke is forever throwing an anchor out to the mainstream of Greco-Roman history to show that these mm-hmm. things were not done in a corner, that mm-hmm. these things are very public. You can trace them chronologically also back to Roman records.
Mm-hmm. And Luke records numerous titles and such that we had no idea existed, and we were skeptical of, such as tetrarchs and agiarchs. And we said, Luke got it wrong. And then archaeology changed all that, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Years ago, Sir William Ramsay said that Luke should be considered amongst the first-rate of historians. He's the kind of guy who dots every I and crosses every T.
Yeah, Ramsay's
Would
right.
Would you say, I was about to ask if that still applies today.
Well, there's no question that, Ramsay began from a very objective position, too. He was setting out to disprove Christianity, very much like Bart Ehrman. And he was simply convinced by the evidence. Luke has it exactly right in the book of Acts. All the places they visited are in order. They can be seen today yet in ruins, many cases. Some places not, of course, Athens, for example. But these places are chronologically correct. They're spatially correct, geographically correct. And indeed, his accuracy is really overpowering.
In fact, in the work, it seems numerous times he's trying to tell you the accuracy of a timing. For instance, the first verse of the third chapter of Luke, it talks about all these people that were in power at the time and how long they'd been at the time. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you have about 6 or 7 footnotes trying to get mm-hmm. to the year 28/29. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the 15th year of the Emperor Tiberius, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, when Herod mm-hmm. Antipas was tetrarch of Galilee, when his brother Philip was in charge of Oronitis, Trachonitis, mm-hmm. and those other medical problems, I call them, and the Eastern Shore of the Sea of Galilee. When Lysanias, the Tetrarch of Abilene, when Annas and Caiaphas were high priests, you know, and Luke is bending over backwards to give us that year, and they didn't have the B.C. A.D. system at that time. But beautiful, accurate chronological record.
And we're told that the Gospels generally are seen as Greco-Roman biographies, although Luke could be seen as more of a historiography than a Greco-Roman biography by some people. That also goes to show that if that's the genre they were writing in, how seriously they were taking it as history, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I wrote an article in Luke as a Hellenistic historian. I said he was one of the best.
Mm. And with Luke, he's a... I understand in many cases he's also... Well, let's get this part. You've talked about Luke using footnotes as well. Like, he'll refer to Mary pondered these things in his heart and such. But today, a lot of people say Luke doesn't tell his sources, because I guess we expect us to list sources like we would in modern works. But ancient historians often tell their sources in different ways, didn't they?
Certainly did, and some didn't even report sources. Yeah, you know, which are the various ways of doing that. And Luke is very careful to always keep the focus on the central personalities of his story, not how he got there, except in that very first verse. And so even when he comes on the scene in Acts chapter 16 in the middle of Paul's second mission journey, he does it so beautifully, unobtrusively. He doesn't, beat any drums and have trumpets flourishing away. Then I, Luke, joined the mission crew, and so from now on it's eyewitness evidence. No, no. He simply, as you well know, translates in the first person plural rather than the third person singular and plural. Up to now, the book of Acts has been, he preached, they went. Now we set sail, the famous we passage. What a beautifully... unobtrusive way to announce that you're coming on board. It's master of craftsmanship. It really is.
So what would you think of the idea of someone like Pervo, for instance, who pretty much denounces Acts as if it was just a romantic story or something of that sort?
Well, I'm saying he doesn't know what he's talking about, very, very simply. It's just that, it's that simple. Of all the records in Scripture, Acts is the most accurately fastened down and moored to solid anchor of fact in the Greco-Roman world of any document in Scripture. And therefore, to deny that is simply folly.
And
there are a few German higher critics who also say the same thing. I don't know what their basis is.
And we could even say that Acts could be dated early, since major events that we think should be mentioned aren't, such as the death of Paul, or the destruction of Jerusalem, or the death of James.
Absolutely, or the great fire of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what amazes me is how it's delightful to see how there are more and more New Testament historians that are taking a more conservative position on the dating of the Gospels, meaning earlier and earlier. Now, you all know the name David Noel Friedman. He was the great editor of the Anchor Bible Dictionary. He was a Jew who turned Presbyterian, therefore he's a Christian, but nevertheless, that didn't stop a lot of Christians from being very trenchant higher critics. Not Friedman. He says the only way to explain how the book of Acts ended in chapter 28, where Paul is not appearing before trial yet before Nero, is that that is when it was written. Because otherwise, does Luke like trial stories? Of course he does. He's fascinated by them. Paul is always showing up before the authorities, Greco-Roman authorities, everywhere Paul goes, either governor, local governor, or the mayor of the city, or somebody. Well, Paul is always speaking truth to power. Okay, now we're coming to the biggest trial since Jesus stood before Pontius Pilate, Paul before Nero. Wild horses couldn't have prevented Luke from writing that account, and Luke is writing this before it happened. How could Luke or Matthew, for example, ever write about Jesus' prophecies on the way to the cross, saying, "Don't weep for me, you women of Jerusalem. Weep for what's going to happen to you." Look, Matthew's always dealing with prophecy fulfillment couplets. Matthew would have had to have written, "Then was fulfilled in the latter days in the year 70 when Titus destroyed Jerusalem." He would show for the future how this was literally fulfilled. But he doesn't do it. Why? It hasn't happened yet. No Jew. And don't forget, 64 out of 66 authors in the Bible, or 66 books in the Bible, are by Jewish authors. They could not have refrained from talking about the great destruction of Jerusalem, which ruined Temple Judaism and brought on Synagogue Judaism. They could not have failed to report it if the Synoptics were written, for example, after the fall of Jerusalem. Couldn't happen. This was John A.T. Robinson's argument, and I never think it's been answered. It's just folly to use that old knee-jerk liberal reaction. It was a way of showing that you were a good New Testament critic. All of the Gospels had to have been written after the fall of Jerusalem. Why? Because Jesus predicts the fall of Jerusalem. He couldn't have known that. Therefore, they put the words in his mouth, which is ridiculous because, even pundits, say Jesus, we're not Son of God. There are pundits who have a good feel for the future, and very often they'll predict what happens. And Jesus could easily, only as a man, have predicted the fall of Jerusalem before it happened.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back and we're getting more into the question of Jesus. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Dr. Paul Meyer. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And I'm back with Dr. Paul Meyer, and if you're listening here next week, we are working on getting a very special guest. I'm still waiting for a reply from my email, but he said he'd come on this date, and that's going to be Dr. Ben Witherington, and we are going to be talking about the birth narratives in the Gospels in preparation for Christmas coming up. But now we got Dr. Paul Meyer here. We're talking about ancient historiography, so let's go to the Gospels here as we wrap up our time with you. One reason we're told we can't trust the Gospels is, for instance, they're anonymous sources.
Well, it's kind of ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, when you have an author who wants to turn attention not to himself but to the great story that he's writing,
right.
And it was more familiar in those days to do anonymous writing rather than today, where the author certainly wants to be known by his own name and spell it correctly and pronounce it correctly. That's today's particular methodology, but not in the ancient world. And so very, very many other documents also are sometimes falsely attributed to an author. You got to watch out for those in terms of all these crazy lost gospels. Oh, everybody's making such a fuss about it today, aren't they, Nick? It's unbelievable. The books that never made the final cut that should have, it's almost ridiculous to see how suddenly people will swallow the camel of all this false gospel business and, strain at the gnat of Christianity in terms of the provability. It's just ridiculous what happens.
With anonymous sources, I've been told, for instance, that Plutarch's writings are anonymous, and the only way we know he wrote them is his grandson later on says, "Yeah, Plutarch wrote those." Are there some other sources, and can you confirm Plutarch is anonymous?
Oh, yeah, I would say the nephew's right in that case. It was just kind of a nice affectation, you might say, this way. I think the anonymous author maybe wants to be discovered someday somehow, but he's being very careful, to hide behind the screen in the process. I would say that most of the ancient works later on do have an authorship ascribed to them. It's those early ancient epics that are so very problematic in terms of authorship. You know, even the Iliad and the Odyssey, some have claimed it's not by the same Homer. Others have claimed that Homer couldn't have written the two because the language changes somewhat, but it's clear that he wrote the Odyssey much later than the Iliad. So that may be one reason, you know, our styles change through the years. And generally it all goes back, but again, we don't find anywhere in the Iliad or the Odyssey saying, I, Homer, wrote these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, another argument that's used, and this seems to be a favorite one of critics, especially on the internet, is this kind of stuff that was going on in the Gospels, it should have been talked about so much more, but we have so much silence. And so the argument from silence seems to be the number one argument I see nowadays. How about...
Yeah, well, it's a stupid argument to use because the argument from silence is the weakest possible form of argumentation you can use. Simply because an ancient source doesn't mention something does not mean it did not happen. The way we usually put it is this. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly... there are so many other things happening in the ancient world, especially since all these events took place sort of in the boondocks of the ancient world. You see, Palestine was not that big in terms of the ancient world. It was a gateway to Egypt, which was big. It was on the road from Syria, which was big, to Egypt, which was big. And Palestine was only the gateway. And for that reason... the Jews were somewhat looked down upon by the other nations, and so what good could come out of them? There were some exceptions. Ptolemy II, for example, wanted the Hebrew scriptures translated into Greek, and he had 70 scholars, you know, come from Jerusalem and do the translating job, hence the Septuagint, the 70, as the earliest Greek translation of anything in the Bible, and that's the Old Testament in Greek. But generally they were somewhat... discriminated against, and therefore who cares what happened in Jerusalem. So I'm surprised, really, that even Jesus' name shows up in that first century after his death and resurrection, because it does, you know, in those famous six or more places that we all know about.
You know, it's so interesting that you were saying that, because usually when I meet critics who say, why wasn't Jesus talked about more? I say, it doesn't surprise me that Jesus wasn't talked about so much. What surprises me is he was talked about at all.
At all. Indeed, yeah, right. Yeah.
I wrote a blog a few months ago, and I called it, Jesus is Not Worth Talking About. And I said, because if you were sitting in Rome, you're a good historian of time, and you're hearing these claims from Judea about somebody, you say, okay, he's from Judea? Yes. He's a Jew? Yes. He's doing miracles? Yes. Okay. Has he ran for office? No. Is he a political leader? No. Well, how did he die? He was crucified. Oh, okay. Well, get out of the way. I got more important things to do here.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, good way to do it. Well done, Nick.
Yeah, we're even usually told that back in this time of our history that people back then were really gullible and bought into all these ideas, so surely miracle claims would travel far and wide, and everyone would write about miracles.
Well, it's true. We do have quite a few miracle stories in antiquity. Again, that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't happen. This is, again, a wrong conclusion from the surrounding evidence. You have claims that were unsubstantiated from the ancient world, no question about that. Apollonius of Tyana is one special case involved where he supposedly did miracles, and there are still mythical accounts of some wondrous things that happened at the time of the emperors, at their birth or death, or the blood-red comet coming in the sky heralding Caesar's assassination, and so on. Again, the ancients liked a big, colorful story, a sensational, if you please, story, as do moderns. And evidently, I don't, but I mean other moderns who do. And for that reason, they would often pack their accounts with things supernatural. I'm not trying to say, therefore, that the scriptures, Old and New Testament, are the only sources in the ancient world that deal with the miraculous. No, there were others.
But I can already hear the critic saying, well, Dr. Mao, you believe in the miracles of the New Testament and the Old Testament, but it seems you're incredibly skeptical of those outside. Aren't you just doing special pleading?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. because so many of the miracles also include known mythical elements. The Matis Personae, the cast of characters, is very, very mythical. You have Zeus and Hermes visiting the city of Lystra, for example, long before Paul and Barnabas and Timothy did. Timothy comes later, I take it back. Paul and Barnabas did. And, Zeus and Hermes were in the form of a man trying to get the lay of the land from the locals, and nobody gave them the time of day, so they were angry at the people of Lystra and turned them into frogs. Except one dear old couple, Bacchus and Philemon, who not only gave them the time of day, but gave them lunch as well. And so they then turned them, gave them the gift of immortality by turning that couple into big oak trees at the start of their driveway, evidently crossing the mailbox or something. I don't know. But in any case, there's a miracle story from a mythical basis involving mythical characters who never lived. Hello? Okay. There's a case where, naturally, I regard the historical nailing down of the New Testament and Old Testament accounts far more highly than these stories out of Greek mythology. So I am being consistent with the evidence.
What about other claims, though, such as, say, the great reign of Marcus Aurelius or of the time that Vespasian healed a blind man?
Well, again, in order to maintain your credentials as a great Roman emperor supported by the gods and inspired by them, you're going to make larger claims, too. And for that reason, they augment any stories from antiquity, no question about it. And what if Vespasian had come along and had this hired done for him, or had somebody come along claiming vision, you know, like false television prophets do in the Bible Belt, you know, and they're claiming the heal, and the cripple suddenly walks, you know, the same cripple who'd walked in with a crutch his head at a time, you know. So these things could happen in antiquity, too.
Yeah, and it's good to know that the healing was claimed to have been done also through Serapis, who happened to be the patron deity in Alexandria, which just happened to be a city that was hoped to give Vespasian in its favor. So a lot of political reasons why they'd want to hype this kind of thing up.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. You always had the favor of the gods. Not that they all believed in them, but this was the national state religion, the official mythology. And this is why, they will take anything and give it a nice sacred background. Mm-hmm. When Caesar was assassinated, or when Augustus was, I'm trying to figure who would know. Augustus, they saw an eagle come down, and that was his soul flying to heaven, you know, and so forth.
David Enstone Brewer, in his book, The Jesus Scandals, in fact, says that miracles would have been, in many ways, an embarrassment to the Christians because the Roman world, by and large, looked with skepticism, and that would have been making Jesus seem like a modern televangelist, but they had to include the miracle claims because they couldn't deny them.
Exactly. So despite the evidence and despite the cultural norms at the time, they happened. You know, and once again, if these things happened as the Bible claimed, would you expect the record to be any different?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be. We cannot but testify what we've seen and heard. Acts chapter 4 or 5, remember? Yeah.
Yeah. It's also interesting, since you mentioned in light of multiple attestation as being an important criteria, is that these miracles, they do have multiple attestation.
Certainly do. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Even in non-Christian records, that's what's so neat.
Yeah, but when it comes to the Christian record, sometimes some critics will say, well, the Gospels were just borrowing from one another, so there really isn't no independent attestation in the Gospels.
No, they're all independent to some extent. You can tell it. To be sure, the synoptics have some of the same material or similar material, but there's enough difference in them, and also certainly with the Gospel of John, that we have different source material here.
Mm-hmm. And what I've often told people is that even if Matthew and Luke used Mark, which is quite likely, it doesn't mean they didn't use other sources as well. And in fact, it would really be unheard of back then for them to not use other sources, wouldn't
it? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Luke says it, and as much as many others have taken in hand to do this, you know, I did too,
And
it'd
been
fun
even
if we had some of those other sources showing surviving.
I've even seen some people say, well, how do you know Luke's telling the truth with that? And it's just when I hear that, I think, are you doing anything you can to avoid Luke being an honest historian?
Yeah, or they're bending over backwards. They will try every trick in the book. It doesn't work.
Yeah. And since we were talking about miracles, in fact, in the book of Acts, you talked about the time that Paul and Barnabas went to Lystra and how there was a background to that, that when Paul and Barnabas showed up, the people started saying, it's Zeus and Hermes. They've come back again. They've come back. And they
trying
to go out.
Exactly.
And that
question.
There's
a mythological tale that supports Scripture right there.
Some scholars have even said that when Luke wrote that, he was, in fact, making fun of the Lystrans and citing how gullible the Lystrans were.
Well, clearly, if this really happened, they're worth making fun of. You know, and I'm sure this could happen, absolutely. They were so delirious with mythology in those days, they could believe this kind of thing could happen, sure.
Yeah, and I've seen some accounts of people saying, well, this is just an example of how gullible these people were. They were believing this kind of miracle happened. And what I tell them is, look, you've got an account of this guy who's been lame all his life. This isn't just some psychosomatic condition. All of a sudden, he's up and walking. The fact of the matter then is something has happened, and you have to come up with some way to explain it. And there's nothing wrong about saying it's a miracle. I mean, for all intents and purposes, maybe it wasn't a miracle, just for the sake of argument. But still, there's no reason to just go out and say, well, it couldn't have been a miracle. Right at the start, unless you have some sort of a priori, you know, stance against miracles.
Exactly. Yep. Well, any one of those healing cases, there's always two miracles involved, you know. Not just one. Two miracles. One is the physical healing, and the other is the ability to walk itself when they haven't done this before. So these are all these wonderful paralytics and now suddenly able to walk. It's two miracles every time.
Yeah, I really think it's great that you bring out that point. I hadn't thought about before. Years ago, I had a back surgery done with a scoliosis treatment, and it sure took a long time to learn to walk again. And to picture someone who's been lame or paralyzed for life and never ever walked and suddenly able to do it, that is two miracles taking place.
Yeah. Sometimes they walk and leap and leap for joy. It's just impossible. Look how long it takes humans to walk and how often they fall down. The impossible.
But what about miracles in some other accounts and such that we don't have evidence, yay or nay? For instance, Herodotus records that a horse gave birth to a rabbit, as he says, a male gave birth to a hare. Now, we don't have anything against that. We don't have anything really for it. Should we respond with just skepticism or agnosticism or what?
Well, I think it's perfectly logical to dismiss claimed miracles like that as simply worthless, simply because you don't have a human element involved at all. It's an animal element. They can't report what they were or are doing. Secondly, it's for no legitimate purpose whatever that an elephant give birth to a hare or something like that. I mean, these make no sense logically, whereas every one of Jesus' miracles has sense to it, as a utility to it, and as a purpose. None of these others have any sense whatever. They're only there as monstrosities to show that, ho-ho, something big's going to happen in a short time.
And everything
that... And you find the ancient historians almost feel obligated to talk about some supernatural sign that's going to happen first to herald by way of a beating of the drums in the background, you know, that something big is happening. Even Josephus, a very important New Testament historian, Old Testament for that matter, too, talks about when the great fall of Jerusalem happens and the burning of the temple, how there were weird things happening in the sky and people were misinterpreting things. And every time there's a big change of leadership in Rome, Tacitus is talking about it all the time also, about how, indeed, these monstrosities happen. A bleeding head was dug up, one still bleeding and alive, a head was dug up in the Capitoline Hill in Rome, and therefore it gave the name to the hill, Capitus, you know, for head. I mean, you know, the ancients were very strong in astrology as well, and so they always linked that with something supernatural happening, yeah.
We're going to take our final break with Dr. Paul Meyer. He's going to be with us for about 10 more minutes or so, according to his schedule, so we'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'm Nick Peters, back with my guest, Dr. Paul Meyer, for about 9 more minutes or so, and I do thank him for his time he's given us today. And I do want to remind you all that this is listener-supported radio, that everything we do here, we do to support you, and we don't get paid for this kind of thing. This show I do my own free time, arranging everything and such. But I would appreciate your donations. You can go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com and find out how to donate to me there. That's my own blog. Or you can donate to me through Ratio Christi, the Issues and Answers chapter, and as well through Mike's Ministry of Risen Jesus. Now, Dr. Meyer, before you have to go, let's suppose we've got the skeptic out here who's saying, yeah, this all sounds interesting, but I'm not sure. So this is, first off, a two-part question. First, can you understand his skepticism of the New Testament accounts? And second, what would you recommend this skeptic do?
Well, I can understand skepticism because, you know, we don't see people being raised from the dead today. And so there are miracles that do not evidently get replicated in the modern era. I'm something of a line drawer, I'll admit. I do think that these supernatural phenomena were no longer permitted by God, so that every generation has candid, absolute, empirical proof that these things happen. God doesn't reward unbelief that way and skepticism. And now we have to rest on the evidence of when it was necessary to inculcate Christianity in the ancient world, you had to have extraordinary signs. Fact is, if Jesus showed up today, you know, we'd almost have him, we'd have to have him go through the same cycle to prove that he's the one, because what if he were a false prophet and so on, see? So I can understand that at the inception of all this, you're going to have the supernatural intervention sometimes as a proof. Jesus himself used it. He said, you believe because of the miracles. Blessed are those who have not seen yet believe, he tells Thomas. He's charting the future there. He's saying that from here on, we don't, you know, look at repeated, tangible, material evidence, you know. And indeed, his message must have been successful, because don't forget, with all the problems we have today and all the attacks, Christianity is the number one phenomenon, statistically considered, in the history of the world. There's nothing else on the planet which has the loyalties of over 2 billion, 300 million in the present generation alone. Nothing comes close. Islam may be half that population, but this is the reason, and Nick, I think that we are in everybody's crosshairs. You always attack the front runner. I remember the Republican presidential debates among the candidates. 8 people on the stage. 7 of them gang up on the leader. It happens every time. So we are number one. For that reason, we're the target. And quite frankly, wouldn't you rather be number one than further down the pecking order have to do the attacking? Yeah. And I think it's the reason why we're the wretched double standard in our society today, which goes like this. You dare not attack anyone else's religious faith unless it's Christianity, then help yourself. This is exactly what's happening all around us today. And I think Christians ought to be a little bit more proactive in terms of defending their faith. And especially for the marginal people, these are the people being deceived. Not good Christians, but those who are religion shopping, those who are on the fence. That's the group that's antagonized, or I should that's convinced by the, or unconverted, you know, in terms of the wild, mindless, baseless attacks being made in the faith today.
And how would you suggest that we in the church can be more proactive with regards to this?
Well, I would say read the good apologetics literature. In that, of course, I would, now it's going to be self-serving, read my book, In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, the Early Church, and books by certainly Lee Strobel, and certainly we have a new one coming up, Monette.
Greg Monette.
Yeah, Greg Monette, sure. And we also have other good apologists around today. Absolutely. Gary Habermas, Mike Lacona, great in terms of the resurrection. These are all good reading, absolutely, and very logically and very beautifully set forth.
Well, I know you're going to be going soon, so we got about 4 minutes left with you here. Let's suppose my audience is very curious about you and wants to find out more. Is there any way they can get in touch with you, like a website or anything of that sort?
Oh, sure, yeah. My website is Paul Meyer. That's M-A-I-E-R, three vowels in a row. PaulMeyer.com is my website. And sure, I'd be happy to answer any by email as well.
Yeah, I did have someone even message me and said, for instance, if I wanted to upload some of his materials, the person who messaged me runs the Classic Apologetics website and said, would it even be possible to get some of those articles on that website?
Maybe, but if you come to me, my email and so forth, I certainly send you articles I've written on Jesus' existence, on Josephus and people like this, you bet.
Okay. Now, with about 3 minutes left, is there any final message you would like to leave with my audience?
Well, it would only be, please play fair with the evidence, hear both sides, and then see that on the negative side, as far as the claims of Christianity are concerned, they are so based on human conjecture, on theses that are never proven, on misinterpretation of the evidence, false claims, and sensational deductions from evidence that doesn't exist. Whereas the claims in behalf of Christianity are very objective. They're out there. Compare the documents from the ancient world. See how beautifully they impinge and synchronize with the documents in Scripture. The people and places and events showing up inside the Bible, in many cases, also show up outside the Bible. And the evidence outside the Bible comports beautifully with the evidence inside. And so if it weren't for this being a religion, if this weren't being claims of supernatural accounts, I'm sure that they wouldn't question a thing in the Bible. But because of the fact that you're going to have people hostile to the biblical record for that reason, they simply claim these things can't happen, you have all this ridiculous attack taking place. It simply isn't fair.
Well, Dr. Meyer, I really do thank you for coming on the show. I've even had someone already message me, who's a really good friend of mine, best man at my wedding, and say, today's show has been pure awesome so far. And I have to agree with him. It's been fascinating discussing ancient historiography, and I really like that you just come out and tell it like it is. It's been really incredible. I hope we'll see you back here again sometime.
Good. Thank you, Nick. I hope you had a blessed Thanksgiving and a blessed Advent and Christmas coming up.
May you too.
Righto. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, people, I have to agree that, yes, this has been pure awesome. Ancient historiography can just be so very fascinating. And what Dr. Meyer has told you this whole episode is entirely correct, that the arguments against the faith I find more and more are just so weak entirely. Honestly, I'm not going to be egotistical on things, but I'm just going to say, someone bring forward a challenging objection, please. We've covered it several times, and the ones that are being listened to by the skeptical world are the ones that shouldn't be listened to. There are scholars out there who disagree with Christianity that are well informed on the matters and can still make better arguments. But instead, what we find is constant referencing to the internet atheists. For instance, today, the most common one is Richard Carrier. And Dr. Meyer told us that if these people say Jesus never even existed, they're showing their ignorance, and you don't need to pay attention to another word that comes out of their mouths. And I agree with that. Unfortunately, I have to pay attention in some regards because of the people that Dr. Meyer talked about, the marginal people, the ones that are on the fence. And they're not marginal in terms of value, but they're marginal that they're not really paying attention to much of what's going on, and they can be so easily led astray. As I tell people constantly, there are wolves out there seeking to destroy the flock. Someone like Dr. Paul Meyer will give you that information that you need, and it's not that difficult, really. Go out and pick up a book by him, and he's recommended several others. Lee Strobel, go read some Strobel. Go read some Habermas. Go read some Lacona. He spoke about Greg Monette, someone who's up and coming right now, and Greg Monette is someone we are working with getting on the show right now. In fact, he's going to have some great talk about history. We're working on getting Craig Evans and so many, many more out there. Those people, I want you to be equipped. Okay? I get very, very scared of a church that doesn't take equipment seriously. Some of you know that I write a column for the local newspaper. It's a monthly column on matters of religion. And the last column that I wrote was all about how we can get a revolution in the church. And we've got all the equipment that we need for it right here. We've got all the information. Of course, we're getting more. We're learning more every day, and I don't discourage that. We all need to be going out and seeking and studying to learn more and more. But if we want to change our country, we have everything we need to do it right now. Don't tell me there are churches thriving in the third world in poor conditions. They hardly have access to this kind of information, except for when some people come down there and give those talks, finally, who would give anything to get a page of Scripture, who would just leap for joy at having a copy of Case for Christ. Don't tell me these kinds of churches thrive where they are, and they do, but we here in the West, with our gold mines of information right before us, just can't do it. Yes, we can. You want to know the reality? Too often in the church, we are lazy. That's all there is, unfortunately. And I say that for all of us. There are times I have to really push myself to be reading something or be studying something because it's not really our natural inclination many times. And for too many of us, we think that faith should come easy. That should be something simple. You don't really need to work on faith. No, your Christian life should be a struggle. With anything that you do, regardless, there is a lot of work and effort involved if you want to do it well. if you want to be a good athlete, you're not just going to show up at the games and expect, lo and behold, miraculously, you are going to be great because, well, you're you. And everything's supposed to bow before you. No, you're going to show up at practice regularly and be practicing. And even when you're not at practice, you're going to be practicing on your own time. I remember hearing, for instance, that Michael Jordan would go out and shoot 100 free throws in his own practice every day. And if you wanted to play basketball like that, that's the kind of thing you'd have to do. If you want to be a good writer, you have to write regularly. If you want to lose weight, you have to diet and exercise. If you want to have a successful marriage today, you have to work at it. My wife and I just started attending a church, and we attended this class at Start called Marriage Moments. We didn't, because our marriage is good, but we always want it to be better. And to make it better, that requires work. Love is a commitment, after all. It's saying, I am going to seek the good of the other person for the rest of my life. And you know, our natural tendency is not to do that. Our natural tendency is to look out for number one. And I can tell you many times in our relationship, that has been my tendency. It's been, look out for number one, make sure I get what I want. But it doesn't work that way, and you have to learn to be otherwise. Now, if you're going to work at all of these other things, why not work at what's most important of all, your Christian life? Unless you don't think your entire worldview should hinge around the question of God and who Jesus is, and if that's the case, well, of course you're not going to work on it. But what if Dr. Meyer is right? What if these events really did happen? If this happened, this is something incredible and life-changing. And if you meet anyone who says, well, whether Jesus rose from the dead or not, it really doesn't matter, life's the same anyway, you're meeting someone who doesn't know what he's talking about. If Jesus rose from the dead, everything changes. It means there is someone outside, namely God. And it means he has spoken, and he has spoken in Christ. And then it means your eternal destiny depends on it. Your fate as a human being depends on this. Are you going to live the life God created you to live? Or are you going to just say, forget it, I'm going to go my own way. I don't care if God has acted or not. I'm going to do what I want. So the reality is, I see too many skeptics who approach the New Testament and Christianity, and they haven't really taken these kinds of questions seriously. They have taken a very superficial approach and used the kinds of arguments that Dr. Meyer has told us are nonsense. For instance, this idea where you only use contemporary accounts. No ancient historian does that. Not one of them says that. Well, the Gospels are anonymous. And he's like, it's kind of a dumb argument, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, it is. And then the argument from silence, which should be the least convincing argument whatsoever. And as it turns out today, sadly, it's often one of the most convincing arguments out there. And how does this happen? Because there's an ignorance of history, how it's done. And you know what? I don't blame the atheist for having an ignorance of history. I really don't. I blame the church. And what I've told people over and over is that the reason the world seemed to lose its academic bearings, that we went off into a void of anti-intellectualism where the weakest ideas are taught and people don't know how to think. Why are we in that position? Because the church dropped those standards first. We abandon the life of a mind. The rest of the world simply followed suit. Well, if we want our revolution, we take it back. And we take it back with a vengeance. Well, we're going to come up to the last segment of the show here. I hope you're enjoying it. I know I'm sure not as enjoyable as Dr. Paul Meyer, but I really hope you're getting something out of it. So we'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. My call number is 714-242-5180. I'd like to talk about something related to this, because we're getting ready to come to the Christmas season here. I hope next month to have a lot of Christmas-themed shows on here. Like, for instance, I'm going to really start off with Dr. Ben Witherington. That'll be a fascinating show discussing the birth narratives in the Gospels, the virgin birth, the census, the genealogies, matters of that sort. I really think if this gets pulled off, it'll be a fascinating show. But my wife and I went to see my in-laws for Thanksgiving, had a really good Thanksgiving with them, and we're heading back, and I drive by a church, and I see a sign that says something like, "A silent night that calmed the chaos." That's what Christmas is. And you know, I'm glad a church is thinking about Christmas and seeing what it is, but I was saying, it's a night that calmed the chaos pretty much the same way the troops landing on the beaches of Normandy calmed the chaos. We have a song about silent night, holy night, and I definitely grant you it was a holy night. I don't think I'd say much about being silent. And let's remember that just a couple of years because of that night, according to Scripture, Herod starts slaughtering the infants in Bethlehem. And if you're skeptical of that, we're going to cover that next week more. But he starts the slaughter because he doesn't want anyone to take his place on the throne. This is why, actually, if you want to ask me what my favorite version of a Christmas story is in the Bible, I'm not going to take you to Matthew. I'm not going to take you to Luke. In fact, I'm going to take you to the book of Revelation. What? What, the book of Revelation talks about the Christmas story? Yes, yes it does. In the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, we read the account of a woman giving birth to a child, and this child will rule the nations with a rod of iron, and the devil is waiting to devour this child as soon as it's born. Folks, this child is Jesus. Who else is going to rule the nations that way but Jesus himself? And the devil immediately sought to destroy Jesus, to put an end to the work that he was doing. And the very first attempt was through Herod. Christmas should be seen as more the shot heard around the world. Christmas is an invasion story. It's the story of God saying, "This world has gone wrong. Now is the time that I am going to come and change things majorly." And this is what it's meant by "in the fullness of time." This was a time the world had a great unity for a message. It was a common language. you want to communicate, you could communicate in Greek anywhere, much like you can communicate in English anywhere today. There was a common road system. Travel was easier than it had ever been. There was a common culture in many cases. The world was united in a Hellenistic culture. The world was, in fact, ripe for the taking. Now, some people will say, well, why didn't Jesus come today when we have TVs and all this other equipment? Because we all know everything we see on TV is real, of course. People have been making fake accounts for the longest time. And if you saw it on TV today, you would dismiss it entirely. Look, how many of you have seriously gone out, for instance, and investigated a miracle of, say, Benny Hinn? Or a Catholic healing shrine? Or a miracle of that sort? Very, very few of you have. I'm thankful that Craig Keener wrote his book, Miracles, where he did go out and he did document these healings. But very few people have done it. And I don't blame you being skeptical in many cases. When you talk about these people on TBN, such faith healers, yeah, I'm skeptical of them too. Because I know their message, and it's not a good one. And when you talk about a lot of these mega pastors and such, like, for instance, I've got a very good friend who's constantly warning me, and rightfully so, about what's going on in Charlotte with Stephen Furtick of the Elevation Church. Yeah, I'm skeptical of a lot of these guys. I say, always watch the doctrines that these people are promoting. Watch the messages that they're teaching and saying, do they line up with Scripture or not? And make sure they are teaching you about those essential doctrines. Those are the doctrines that need to be emphasized most. But very few of us are going to go out and examine these claims. Reality is, the ancient world was pretty darn skeptical too. And like Dr. Meyer told us, Judea was out in the boondocks. No one would take these claims seriously. Around the time of Jesus, there was an economic crisis going on in Rome. That's what people were interested in. Not going to be in this crisis and say, oh, there was supposedly a miracle worker in Judea. Hey, let's take some of this money that we don't really have and go out and investigate this. They're not. They're going to write it off entirely, which is exactly what they did. As I said, I'm not surprised that so few people mention Jesus. Well, it's not very few by comparison. I'm surprised anyone mentioned him at all. That should just astound us in the ancient world. How was it that a Jewish pastor, rabbi, who never led an army, never ran for office, never traveled outside of Judea, and in fact died the worst possible, most shameful death that you could think of, how is it that that person ended up being talked about so much? And if anyone wants to find out more about the shamefulness of Christianity, we're going to have a good guest coming up later on next year, that January 4th, I'm due to have David Da Silva, author of Honor, Patronage, Kinship, Purity, come on the show to talk about, well, honor, patronage, kinship, and purity. And I really hope you're going to be listening. It's going to be a fascinating show, bring out a lot of concepts that really aren't understood. But that Jesus gets mentioned should strike us all as incredible. You know, there are some people that you interact with today or say, well, you know, God didn't choose a very good method to get his word out, did he? Obviously, he didn't. I mean, here we are 2,000 years later in another culture, different from time, space, language, culture, everything, and we're talking about that message that he did such a poor job of getting out. Considering, Dr. Meyer said there are 2.3 billion people and we're the front runner in the world today? Yeah, I think a pretty good job was done in getting the word out. You know how the word got out? Hey, listener, it was by people like you. People like you and I, just going out there and doing our job. Go look in the Gospel of Matthew. Look at me in. Verses 18 through 20 is what we call the Great Commission. To go into all the nations, teaching, making disciples. That was a part we've left out, making disciples and baptizing them and remembering that Jesus is with us till the end of the age. Like, this is a theme of Matthew. In the beginning, Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. And in the end, Jesus is still God with us. It's simply incredible. You know, we'll get asked sometimes about the question of those who've never heard. I'm not going to answer that one right now for you. If you want to see it, I've probably got something on my blog where I've written about it. There's very few topics I haven't written something about in this field. But when it comes to those who've never heard, we're only told one thing really overall, I think, in Scripture. Let's get the message out. We are never told Plan B. We are given the Great Commission, and nowhere in Scripture does it say, and if you don't fulfill the Great Commission, this is what I'm going to do instead. No, you just fulfill the Great Commission. It is your requirement. It is your call. It is not optional. If you are going to call Jesus Lord, you'd better be doing the Great Commission. For all he does say in the Gospels, you call me Lord, Lord, but don't do what I say. How can we dare say Jesus is Lord of our lives if we are not doing what he said? And of course, we're all going to fall short in this. We all have to find our ways of doing evangelism. I can tell you, for instance, I love talking at a church before a crowd, doing this kind of show. Yeah, I love it. I can do that. Okay? But if you go and ask me to approach one stranger on the street and initiate a conversation, I am scared silly at that point. That's not what I do. But you know what? Some of you out there can do that. God bless you. Do it, and please make sure you're doing it well. Please make sure you're not being one of these street preachers out there that's just preaching hellfire and brimstone and making a mockery out of all this. Yes, there's a place for a message of judgment. It has to be taught. But the message is not all judgment. And make sure you're giving the historical reality. You're showing people this is something that really happened. By and large, if you haven't, the message you're giving, it's one they've heard before. They already have rejected it. But if you start giving them a message with a historical reality, all of a sudden, you're going beyond where these are my personal feelings about Christianity, or this is what Christ has done in my life. And what Christ has done in your life is great. Okay? But the Mormons can claim similar. Jehovah's Witnesses can make similar claims. Muslims can make claims about what the Quran has done for them. But as soon as you start saying, this is what happened in the world outside of my own mind, all of a sudden, you're pointing to a much more real reality there. And people have to respond. You know, in our culture, people don't really have much problem with God. You want to be seen as inclusive, so the New Ager talks about God. Mormons talk about God. Muslims talk about God. Christians talk about God. Okay, it's fine in a pluralistic society, unless you're the atheist can't stand hearing about it many times. Now, not all of them are like that. Yeah, there are some atheists who just say, well, that's just your false belief, but no big deal to me. There are a lot who don't take that stance, unfortunately. But as soon as you talk about Jesus, you are talking about someone very, very specific. You're essentially talking about God with skin on, and people have to respond. Everyone has to respond to Jesus. Every religion today that's come after Jesus is having to say something about him. And the ones that come before, they're having to say something about him. A Hindu can try and make Jesus an avatar. A Buddhist can make Jesus an enlightened one. A Confucian can make Jesus into a great teacher. Muslims had to make him into a prophet. They couldn't just say, well, we're just going to ignore this Jesus figure. Everyone has to deal with Jesus. Even today, you'll find atheists for Jesus out there. There was a movement, in fact, the gospel of Christian atheism. Atheists have to deal with Jesus, and unfortunately, too many of them are taking this lazy route and saying, Jesus never even existed. Folks, don't take such a claim like that seriously. As Dr. Myers had said there, there was just no basis for that in history. None whatsoever. No ancient scholar would take that stance that's worth any credibility whatsoever. I read you the quote that he has that's cited in Mike's book, and I'm going to read it again here, where he says, for Jesus' existence, the total evidence is so overpowering, so absolute, that only the shallowest of intellects would dare to deny Jesus' existence. He's not holding back, and he still stands by that today. Which means what he's telling you is, if you deny Jesus' existence, you got a shallow intellect. Now, he's not telling you, if you deny Jesus is the Son of God, risen from the dead, who worked miracles, you got a shallow intellect. You don't. There are brilliant scholars out there who deny that. And we need to recognize that. Just because someone is a non-Christian in the field, it doesn't mean they don't know what they're talking about. There are a number of non-Christian scholars worthy of respect. But unfortunately, I think a lot of times they are playing fast and loose with the evidence. I do think Bart Ehrman is really dishonest a number of times the way he presents the evidence. And to be fair, sadly, there are Christians who I think are dishonest with the way they present the evidence. I've written works that are critical of apologetics works, even because I think they're not serving the church. You're getting a shallow, shallow treatment. And personally, I only want the best on my side. That's why on this show, I'm trying hard to bring you the best in scholarship to deal with the issues, and trying to do it on a different range of topics that I consider important. In fact, if some of you have some ideas for guests and such that are worthy of consideration, that are great Christian scholars that should come on, email me. Let me know. You can find my email at my blog site of deeperwaters.wordpress.com, but if you can't look it up right now, I suppose you're driving, you're listening to this, it's very easy to know what my email is. It's Apologia, and that's APOLOGIA, which is where we get apologetics from. Apologia Nick, N-I-C-K, which is my name, apologianick @gmail.com. Let me know. I'm always looking for more scholars to come on, and I'm always discussing and looking at books at bookstores and such and saying, I wonder who would be a good guest to have on my show. And I hope, by and large, most of you have been satisfied with the guests that we have. And I hope you're sharing this podcast with your friends and going back and looking at episodes. There are many times in debates with people I've said, when an objection's come up, really? I already got that one covered. And I can point to a podcast where it was talked about. It's a really helpful tool in this day and age. Well, the call just came in to me that our time is running out, unfortunately. Now, I'd like to remind you, next week we are looking to have Dr. Ben Witherington come on. Whew. there is an excellent guest to have as well. There it is. All the great guests lined up. I really hope you're benefiting. Let's start with Dr. Ben Witherington. And if you don't know his works, shame on you. Get familiar with him. He is going to be talking with us about the birth narratives as we begin looking at Christmas next month. And I really hope you'll be with us. We've got some great guests lined up. Still working on one guest for on the 14th, but I hope we're going to be doing you some great shows. Well, until next time, I'm Nick Peters. I'm signing off for Deeper Waters Podcast, and I hope I'll see you next week.